I have never learned from a victory. I haven't. The definition of our age is how we manage these three incredible. If you take any of them independently, you've got an epic defining event. What we've got to do a better job of is making sure that the Evans and the Logans and yes, the Adams have the support they need to pursue their dream here. Let's let the will of the market dictate what our options are rather than a political class who largely doesn't understand the dynamics of the business community. I'm not sure that any time in human history, even back to the Renaissance, have you seen this confluence and change in culture and technology and finance. Back, you know, I guess this is going to be the theme of our conversation.
Welcome back to the Middle Tech Podcast. You've got Logan Jones and Evan Knowles recording out of J.P. Blevins' office here in downtown Lexington. Today we are joined by Adam Edlin, who is the CEO and founder of Edlin Renewables. So Edlin Renewables is doing some awesome stuff. We're excited to have Adam back on the show. It's been about 3 years since we've gotten to talk about Edlin Renewables, so we're excited to dive in. Before we get into this conversation, we just want to get a quick word from our sponsors. Before highlighting our sponsors, we'd just like to state that the views and content shared on this platform do not necessarily reflect those of our show sponsors. Middle Tech is presented by KY Innovation, the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development's Office of Entrepreneurship. KY Innovation exists to support and develop Kentucky's startup ecosystem, and we are proud to be supported by an organization whose mission aligns so closely with ours. If you're a founder building in Kentucky, you need to check out the resources that KY Innovation has to offer. You can find more information by clicking the link in our show notes or going to kyinnovation.com.
Middle Tech is sponsored by Bolt Marketing. Take your website to the next level with a website that's built to work. At Bolt Marketing, they're revolutionizing websites for small businesses that are affordable, customizable, and hassle-free. Whether you have a construction company, a boutique clothing store, or you own a hot yoga studio, they have options for you. Click the link in our show notes to explore their marketing options that can transform your marketing and grow your business. And as a personal note, Bolt Marketing built our website, and they were awesome to work with throughout the entire process. We highly recommend working with them.
All right, Adam. Welcome back on.
Man, a lot has gone down in 3 years, guys. It's obviously I've gotten to bump into you two pretty regularly, but this is exciting. 3 years, we got a lot to talk about. The world has changed in ways large and small, and yet we're still standing. So that's worthy of celebration alone.
Absolutely. We were joking before we started recording. It was episode 138, May of 2021. That was kind of right after COVID had started going down on the downtrend a little bit. But I still remember getting in that office with you and like, first off, I want to compliment you. You're a very good talker. And so you started talking. I was like, this is going to be a fun episode because you can just kind of riff it and it sounds really good. So we're excited to have you back on for a conversation. You know, since it's been 3 years, I'm sure a lot of the people that are going to be listening to this might not be super familiar with Edlin Renewables. So let's just start off with the first question. Whenever you're talking to somebody that knows nothing about Edlin Renewables, how do you describe what you do?
Yeah, so Edlin Renewables is a Lexington, Kentucky-based developer of large and small-scale renewable energy projects around the country. And our founding mission is to bring the promise of renewable energy to forgotten America. And guys, this is exciting because really, while that's our mission, the premise of our business plan is that the green energy revolution and all that that implies is the greatest wealth-generating opportunity of our lifetime, certainly since the advent of the internet. So the question is, how do you leverage this extraordinary confluence of change in technology and economy and culture to leave communities that have been left behind better off as a result of your labor? And so that's who we are and what we do. We're a growing concern on Main Street in Lexington, Kentucky. And I think it's really cool to us that our presence is on Main Street in a town like Lexington. That has such an ancestral tie to like the coal industry for one, to have, you know, a fairly hot boutique renewable energy development firm headquartered with a great big sign on Main Street is pretty cool. So we're excited about what we're doing. We think we have caught the spirit of the era. We've brought together really talented people and we're affecting big change in places that deserve it.
Absolutely. Why Kentucky? So what about this region? You mentioned kind of our history with coal, the opportunity there to really bring in a new energy source, alternative energy here. What other aspects about this region and maybe Kentucky specifically are you excited about and your team really taking advantage of?
That is a great question. We're here because I'm a patriotic Kentuckian. I'm not possible anywhere else. You know, I've been fortunate to travel to 30 countries around the world. I've seen some really cool stuff, but I am a Kentuckian to my core. I couldn't exist anywhere else. The downside to this is that Kentucky is the hardest place in America to do a renewable energy project. One, it's because our leaders never contemplated a renewable energy future, right? So we are pioneering ground that had never been broken before. And secondly, and I know we're going to get into this later, we've got an entrepreneurial culture here that is a little fearful of failure, right? So being committed to green energy in a place that traditionally has been hostile to it, having really been liberated of any fear of failure, this maybe isn't the most natural place in the world to ply my craft. But we're doing it because, honestly, fellas, and you guys know me well enough to know, I had one too many SOBs tell me that you couldn't bring renewable energy to coal country. And so we've proven them wrong. And when I was with you 3 years ago, I think we had a pretty compelling vision that reimagined Appalachia and the role that it has played in literally powering the industrial development of America for 100 years. We had a vision that they could be relevant for the next 100 years as part of a green energy economy. And now that project I talked to you about is under construction and employing out-of-work coal miners and others displaced by the disappearance of the coal economy. And we're about to replicate it about a half dozen other places in Appalachia. And that doesn't include what we're doing now in the western United States and in the deeper South. So, you know, it's a great question. It's foundational. Why? I think it's kind of like when they asked, I think it was Edmund Hillary, why climbed Everest, because it's there, right? And I think what's super cool about entrepreneurs and people who have the spirit that the three of us do and the people who are so committed to your show is we want to pull it off because most people say that's something that can't be done. And that is a key motivator for me beyond the profit motive, which is powerful. You know, proving people wrong, proving naysayers wrong, making history, building legacy, that's my why. And it's the why of my firm. And it's, you know, while we're here doing what we do, for us, it's as natural as breathing.
And you have a history of doing things that generate impact. So one of the parts of the episode that we recorded with you originally that I was listening back to last night, we focused a lot on some of your background. So we don't have to go as in depth to it this time since we've already talked about that. But give us the high level of your career leading up to starting Edelin Renewables. You're very involved in Kentucky state government. So tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely.
Again.
Listen, I am by training and background a politician, right? And so I came from Meade County, Kentucky, the son of a 16-year-old mother and a tobacco farmer father. And I saw a lot about the world that I didn't think was just. And my passion in public service is about opportunity. I mean, I am deeply in love with the American dream, and I don't believe it's an antiquated or outdated notion that we ought to be in the business of maximizing human potential in this country and in this Commonwealth by making sure everybody gets a shot at their best self, right? So that was my primary driver in government. And so I got to be, you know, with Governor Patton, working my way through UK. I think I was the youngest aide to a governor in the country. Certainly a couple of terms later, when I was chief of staff to the first Governor Beshear at 33, I was the youngest chief of staff in the country at the time. It just afforded me great opportunities. And so the thing that I would say about politics is that when it is gotten right, it is really a true meritocracy. You know, if you're willing to work ridiculous hours, if you're fueled by passion, you can rise quickly. And I was able to, right? I got opportunities at a young age that most other people in the space didn't. I got elected to statewide office at 36 as the taxpayer watchdog. I got to run for governor unsuccessfully, but I still got to run a great campaign for governor based on the ideas that I'm now getting to implement as a businessman. It's been a great ride, right? And so for me, it was about how do you take your why? And it's so important that people understand what is their really internal motivation. And money can't be it alone. Those guys, they don't make it. You got to have some kind of other motivation. And mine is building legacy. And so, you know, I got to, because of me, we tracked down all the untested rape kits in Kentucky and the investigation I did as state auditor. We put really high profile public officials who were corrupt in jail. We did a lot of really cool stuff. We left legacy. Well, now in my career, the projects that we're affiliated with, y'all, are so big that they're visible from space. And that's legacy, man. That is really cool. And for me, the opportunity to leverage this unique moment in time to do big, important things and leave people better off as a result of having labored, that's my motivation. And I think it's why we've been successful to whatever extent we've been so far.
I think one of the interesting things about you is how you've married your political background with entrepreneurship. Because I think many entrepreneurs want to, like, you know, stick it to the man. They're not necessarily in love with authority. They might be, a lot of them are actually, you know, maybe anarchist. They're libertarian. Right. They don't love the government. Yep. They don't like people telling them what to do. And I think you're a really interesting blend of this. And I think you have to be that way to do the projects that you're talking about, the size of projects. Talk about how you've leveraged that political side of you, you know, and, man, how you see it fit in entrepreneurship.
That is really insightful, man. That's like an Oprah level question in the degree of circumspection that requires of me. You just pulled out of me something, man, I'm not sure that I had drawn on. And so what I would say is I am a disruptor who believes in the system. And I want to sit with that for a minute, because that might be the best question. And I get asked a lot of questions. That's the best question I have been asked in a long time. And so I think at my core, I'm a reformer and a modernizer. And I think in being both of those things, it requires a certain degree of belief in the system. And so you're right. I'm the libertarian element. I understand it, respect it. It's not my natural place, because I do believe in a system. I do believe in the framework that we've got, however flawed it is. But I do believe in being highly disruptive, but I'm really driven by an impulse for modernization and reform. That's a hell of a question, dude.
Well, we can pull on some strings there with, you know, the thing that we wanted to talk about as part of one of these sections of this podcast was, now that you've been building Eland Renewables and you've been in the business environment here, you know, one thing we wanted to stick on was, what's the climate like here? So what do we need to work on? And we spoke a bit earlier before we started recording about, you know, our want and our need to look at failure differently and create a business environment that is really more entrepreneurial, because that's a necessary component of entrepreneurship is, you know, failure and embracing that. So I think in talking about the climate here, we can kind of pull on the strings there, but give us the high level view of what you see.
So I would say that in terms of traditional economic development in a traditional approach in Kentucky, we've gotten pretty good, right? I mean, we have very aggressive recruitment strategies. We have a robust set of incentives that we can use to recruit companies here. That's been done to tremendously positive effect, most notably with the Blue Oval Battery Factory with Ford in my hometown of E-Town, Kentucky. But fellas, that is, I think, largely the approach of people who fundamentally don't understand entrepreneurship, right? And so I'm very grateful that we've got this really robust approach to economic development in Kentucky based on recruitment. But what the three of us understand, because we're in the space, and the people who listen to you every week understand, is that the future isn't just in recruitment, it is in building human capital here. It is making sure that while it is awesome to have Toyota 12 miles from here, and we really did modernize economic development recruitment in the 80s when we got them, but you really want to build the prosperous, diverse economy of the future, it has to be based on fostering entrepreneurship. The reason Humana is in Louisville is because David Jones Sr. and Wendell Cherry were in Louisville, right? What we've got to do a better job of is making sure that the Evans and the Logans and, yes, the Adams have the support they need to pursue their dream here. And that requires two things. Concretely, it requires capital networks that aren't risk adverse, that understand that you've got to make a big bet on the future. We don't have enough organic capital networks in Kentucky that help companies at the stage you're in expand to the level they need to be. That is fundamental, right? And that's something that can be fixed. It's not going to be fixed by people in government who haven't been entrepreneurs. That is an entrepreneur's understanding of a precondition for organic economic growth that we've got to have in place. The banking culture here is way too conservative, and there aren't dynamic capital networks that reflect how dynamic our entrepreneurs that we're producing are. And that is to say, we have a really talented entrepreneur here who may have gone to UK or Transy or wherever, who loves Kentucky, but they're leaving because the capital networks are elsewhere. That's something we've got to fix. The other is more cultural. And that is, in the South in particular, with exceptions like Atlanta and Charlotte and Nashville and a few other places, we don't have a tolerance for failure. And you can watch it in the way that a couple of high-profile flameouts have occurred, right? You know, we all are familiar with what happened at AppHarvest. We're familiar with what's happened at Rubicon. I'm not here to defend the practices of those companies or those entrepreneurs in every instance, but the fact is they failed while daring greatly. And while AppHarvest doesn't exist today, and while AppHarvest made some decisions at the late stage that I think weren't consistent with their company values, the fact of the matter is in Moorhead, Kentucky is one of the 10 largest buildings on the planet, right? And so while AppHarvest didn't work, trust me, the second or third concern that comes in there will, in controlled environment agriculture, will have a presence in Kentucky because the folks at AppHarvest tried, right? And my company, you know, you asked me one of the best questions I've been asked in years. Let me give you an example of one that really pissed me off lately. And that is, I'm sitting down talking to a reporter with a national business publication in the last couple of months. And the question was, it looks like you've become an overnight success in the renewable energy industry. How did you do it? Well, I have sweat, bled, lost sleep, shed years off my life over 7 years to help get this first coal-to-solar project to reality. It took me 7 years from concept to construction. And y'all, we've got to have, we are small C conservative in Kentucky and in the South. And what that means is we are not as welcoming of daring greatly as we should be. And when you recognize daring greatly as an asset, it means you have to have a higher tolerance for failure. And it happens. I fail multiple times every single day. In my life, I have failed more than I have succeeded. But the entrepreneur is, the core entrepreneur is the freest person on the planet. Because when you fail every day and you get up, you are liberated from the fear of failure. Because I know that if my company were to blow up tomorrow, that the day after, I'd mourn it for a couple of days, but the day after, I would pick myself up, dust myself off, and start again. I've done it in politics. I have done it in business. I know what it's like to be flat on my back. Every entrepreneur worth their salt has been there. And I've now been through it so many times that I feel sorry. Let me be really crystal clear about this. I feel sorry for people who are still governed or dictated by fear. I get it. It's literally been beaten out of me. But that is the essence of entrepreneurship. And we have got to build support mechanisms that reward that impulse. And it means having capital available. It means having a network of people who have failed, succeeded, failed again, and succeeded again. And that's something, candidly, we don't have enough of in Kentucky. And you're just not going to get it, particularly when your political environment is dominated by process-oriented people like lawyers or people who don't have the body of work that I've just, in the body of experience that I've just explained.
And I think one important thing is if you take a step out, I talk about this with friends all the time when we have this exact discussion. If you take a step out of Kentucky for a moment and you look at the scale of what's going on in Silicon Valley, New York City, Atlanta, you know, the blowups that might have happened here, whether it's AppHarvest, like you said, or Rubicon, that happens monthly in Silicon Valley. That happens almost weekly in Silicon Valley.
And so it's almost celebrated, right?
Exactly,
it's because
right.
We are smarter. I have never learned from a victory.
Yeah.
I haven't. I've been blessed with a lot of defeats. But you also learn it, to quote Mitch McConnell, which is ironic coming from me, I know, but there's no education in the second kick of the mule. I tend not to make the second mistake twice, but treating life as a learning experience is so important, and it's the essence of entrepreneurship. And I think it's why our class is the wrong word. Our cohort make better leaders because you're not afraid of failure. And being liberated from the fear of failure doesn't mean being injudicious. It doesn't mean being reckless. It just means that you're willing to be bold in dealing with the consequences of not succeeding.
Don't go into the unknown. You know,
amen.
That's the big thing there, is to identify a problem, go into the unknown, and just see how far you can take it. And Jonathan and Nate with Rubicon, you know, they took those things very far. They took them public.
And dude, anybody who thinks those two guys are done,
no,
they're far from done. I think they need to take, and I know for a fact they're both taking some time to learn valuable lessons. I know that I have, but anybody who thinks Nate Morris or Jonathan Webb are done, doesn't understand what it means to be an entrepreneur. And listen, you know, there are the great thing about being an entrepreneur is there's always a second or third act. There are as many acts as you're willing to pick yourself off, dust yourself off, and try again. But failing while daring greatly is an attribute. It's not a negative. And we've got to develop a culture that recognizes that if we're going to be as good as our people.
I love that. And I really do think it's a cultural thing, because it's something that you almost have to instill in your young people from a very young age, that, hey, you should be going out and stepping out of your comfort zone. You should be going out and seeking out things that you're likely going to fail at, and building that resilience up so that by the time you get to the point where you're in high school, you're in college, you're out of college, and you're getting into a career, that's a muscle that you've worked, that you're comfortable being uncomfortable. It's something I've talked about a lot. It's not just in business. It's something we should teach our young people from everything that they do.
And I think that's a learned behavior. I think human, you know, billion years of human preservation is based on the belief of self-preservation. I get it. But being an entrepreneur teaches you to me, you fail so many times that you're liberated from the fear of failure. And I think that that's something to be celebrated. And, you know, whether it's the business press who plays an important role, I think putting themselves in the shoes of other people is really important. I think you two in particular have struck such a nerve with Middle Tech because you are authentic and passionate about the topic, right? You're not some dude who used to cover, you know, cuisine or movies or the sports beat who's been moved to the business desk. You're here because this is where your passion is, and you're providing content to a specific audience that's not being served. And that's why I'm so passionate about Middle Tech. We got to talk about us being a sponsor next year, but we'll get to that.
We can definitely get to that. So you mentioned earlier after Evan's question about being a modernizer, and I want to take a step back for a second and get back into this conversation of how you're kind of, you've had the experience being in politics and you're also an entrepreneur. I think that's essential for what you're trying to do, because you're going into a space, into the energy space, that one is so critical. Energy is the origin of everything. There's nothing without energy. And trying to get that into a sustainable place that can kind of take us into this next phase of the future is a very, very hard thing to do. And without being able to navigate the system, I don't think you'd be able to make the change that you're trying to make there. So I think that's a critical piece of this. But kind of talk through what's gone on over the past 3 years. You mentioned it, you know, it's taken 7 years for you to get to this point where you have this project up and running. Give us an idea of the expansion of Edlin Renewables and what you've been up to for the past 3 years building this stuff.
So we're now working on a couple of dozen projects that we're working to advance through various stages of development in 13 states, right? So we range from Pennsylvania coal country to the Pinelands of South Georgia, to Pueblo tribes in New Mexico. And we will, last time I was with you, I think I teased a couple announcements that you guys got to raise within a month or two after me having been on the show. We will have a couple of major announcements about utilizing the green energy revolution to diversify the winner's circle, to make it more inclusive of people of different backgrounds, of different races, of different geographies. And we're super excited about this, because what we pioneered in coal country, I think is proof positive that we can bring opportunities of the green energy economy to forgotten places. You know, we're doing this in Pueblo communities in New Mexico. That's super cool. The stuff that we're going to be doing in between that we'll announce over the next couple of months and make sure that you are privy to, we are super excited about. Because this is, fellas, if your listeners take one thing from me here today and make it actionable, whether it's as an entrepreneur or as an investor or someone who cares about public policy or just about anticipating the future, the primary economic driver for the next at least 50 years is going to be the electrification of everything, right? And people get hung up on EVs and the fits and starts with how quickly. That is just the tip of the iceberg. We are fundamentally changing how we power every facet of our lives, and that power is going to be provided by green electrons. This is a market force. It is a non-negotiable. It is largely happening in a reaction to your generation, the millennials and younger, that are now driving market behavior. And when you see enormous automakers making these big bets on EVs, they're not doing it because they're dumb. They're doing it because they've spent tens of millions of dollars in market research. They know where the economy is shifting. And so the thing about anticipating the future is you may be ahead a little, you may be ahead a lot, but the gravitational pull of the green electron economy is going to be the primary driver of the economy globally for at least 50 years. And so what we've done at Edelin Renewables is try to find out how we put our little vessel in the middle of this gravitational pull so we can benefit from it. And governments and businesses and nonprofits and investors and everybody in between need to be evaluating this incredible force of nature and economy and figuring out how they can benefit from it, because it's here to stay. It's just the way the world is going, and it is going to hasten, not slacken.
Where do you put solar in the breakdown of renewable energy? So you've got hydroelectric, you've got wind, solar, now you've got some nuclear projects that are really exciting coming online. Where do you put solar and how essential is it in that stack?
It is incredibly essential, because now the panel technology has gotten so efficient that solar is a credible power producer everywhere. I mean, there are large solar arrays in Vermont, fellas. And so anywhere where you're not shaded, when you've got a 550 kilowatt or 600 watt panel, you can produce a ton of power, and that's happening. But make no mistake, the green energy transition is going to be all of the above, right? And so in the nearer term, as you see the share of the portfolio increase exponentially every year with wind, solar, and hydro, we're still relying on traditional sources to provide that baseload, right? Eventually, batteries will solve that problem. But in between, you're seeing that, you know, natural gas is playing an incredibly important role. You've got really smart guys like Bill Gates who placed enormous bets on small scale nuclear as an option. You know, not enough people talk about that. First of all, nuclear at a large scale is impossible to permit because really nobody wants to live next to it, right? We get it. Fukushima, the whole nine yards, I get it. But the bet that Bill Gates and his cohort are making is that the same small-scale nuclear facilities that we use to power the entirety of our submarine fleet, of our aircraft carriers, can be deployed at very small levels to provide a lot of power. And I think it's a mistake there are no group of people who are ever exposed as fools more than those who bet against American innovation. That is another, put it more bluntly, if you are out there betting against American innovation, you are going to be proven a fool. It always wins. The question is the pace and the scale of the change, right? But I understand the frustration, right? I mean, we're people are out there trying new things. We've talked about the lack of capital available to truly disruptive industries. We've talked about a culture that doesn't value failure as a learning instance. You know, I get it. It conspires to make things tough, but make no mistake, history is written by people who dare. And, you know, that's why I love being on the show.
Out of curiosity, you mentioned there, like, don't bet against American innovation. We are really pushing forward renewable energy. Give us an idea of how other countries are looking to us for inspiration, and especially the ones, India, China, the more developing ones who are farther behind and maybe relying more on fossil fuels. How are we maybe accelerating their adoption compared to our adoption of renewables, and where do you see them on that?
So I, everybody in the world knows I'm a Democrat, right? But I don't get paid to be a Democrat. So this is me being an analyst rather than a partisan. The Inflation Reduction Act and the incentives for green energy literally changed everything globally. It made America the indisputable leader in driving the green energy revolution, which is what folks like me believe that we ought to be. But you have had for 10, 15 years this tremendous flow of private capital into the green energy sector. But what we didn't have were government policies that provided certainty into the place. So when I was with y'all 3 years ago, when we were talking about projects that I was trying to envision, we were talking about a 20% investment tax credit. ITC is an important part of the capital stack. And that was declining. It was going to phase out over a period of years. The Inflation Reduction Act passed a 30% floor. And because of the communities in which I'm developing, brownfield, former energy communities, we get a 10% kicker, guys, which means the tax credit that we get to use that rewards the investment of private capital is twice what I thought it was last time I was with you. And so the result it is having is caused panic in the European Union. You will inevitably see these guys pass some form of the Inflation Reduction Act. Because America is back in a major way when it comes to securing the economic benefits of the green energy revolution. It is a huge accomplishment that we will talk about in hushed tones 50 years from now, the same way our grandparents talked about the New Deal, right? It's that big of a deal. The bad guys here are China, right? And so the deal with the Indians is they're trying to get rich before they get clean. And so their argument, and it's not one without merit, is you got to burn dirty fuel for 150 years before you got rich. We're trying to get rich. That's been the cheapest energy source. That's why we're slower to hit our climate goals than you are. But now with the cheaper available capital, and it's still relatively cheap, it is incenting investment in places like India. The real bad guys, honestly, are China. And y'all have been in my office. I've got I may be the only company in Lexington without a picture of a horse in my lobby. but when you come into my lobby, I've got the what I think is the most iconic photo of the 20th century, Wang Weilin in Tiananmen Square in front of the column of Chinese tanks. One, it's because the founding value of our company is courage. And so every employee in my company can explain to you why that is there. But to bring this back, it's also a reminder that this country and the Western world made an enormous mistake in ceding the green energy supply chain to the Chinese. So when it comes to panel manufacturing, racking, you know, all of the hardware that goes into supplying this, they currently control about 80% of the market. And that's utterly unacceptable. And what has balanced that is the ESG commitment of a lot of publicly traded Western companies who say, we're not going to invest in a project that uses slave labor. And make no mistake, that's what the Uyghurs are in China, that utilizes slave labor to make the energy collection device of the 21st century. And so what the IRA has done is it is insourcing construction and procurement of the physical material that we need to build these arrays. That's incredibly positive, but it is a huge bipartisan failure that we ever let China, a country whose values fundamentally are not that are at odds with individual freedom and free market capitalism, that we ever ceded 80% of the supply chain to these guys is crazy.
Something you said interesting there, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's a perspective I actually haven't heard yet of ESG, which is it was a mechanism to bring manufacturing and force kind of behavior around manufacturing of these vital pieces to our supply chain. Talk about your perspective on ESG, because that was an interesting, I haven't heard that.
Yeah,
Give us the picture of ESG.
It is the marketplace, the consumer, weaponizing capitalism to affect a positive outcome. And so let's drill down into that, guys. What that means is, particularly for your generation, and I'm not that old, I'm not even 50 yet, but for 30-year-olds and 20-year-olds, you're the largest generation in American history by a lot. And this is why the market is now dancing to the tune that you play. It is why nearly every company in the Fortune 500, including the big fossil fuel companies, have sustainability commitments. Because you can't sell a product to a market when you don't reflect their values. And that's why I laugh about the ESG debate, guys. It's the people raising hell about it are a bunch of politicians who have ideological leanings, who have never once signed the front of a paycheck in their life, dictating what the choices ought to be in the free market. Do you see the irony in that?
Are you arguing against it right now or for?
I'm for ESG. Okay. And so, you know, let's use Congressman Barr as an example. Not a member of my party. I greatly appreciate his leadership on China, on arming Ukraine, on standing up for Israel. But Andy Barr's never signed the front of a paycheck in his life. And out here talking about how ESG ought not to exist is an option when it was created because it's speaking to a certain subset of the market. And so if you don't believe that ESG ought to be an approach in a free market, then the answer isn't to legislate it out of existence. It's to let the free market determine whether it will work or not. And so when big dogs like Jamie Dimon or Blankfein or Larry Fink make hundreds of billion dollars of investments in ESG, I think the determinant of whether that should work should be their own success and not some ideologically driven politician who's reading talking points rather than relying on a level of experience that they actually got as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
I think that's the key that you and I discuss a lot is making it market driven and not making it ideals driven. And I think that's what we saw a lot with the ESG movement we saw these companies begin to get these massive valuations because they were saying the right things in some ways. They were going after the ideological part of it rather than competing in the capital market and succeeding and providing the best solution.
Yeah, that was refreshing because I 100% agree with you. It's got to be a free market dynamic. And that's why I was like, are you for it or against it right now? Because it was confusing there for a second, but you're so right. Like you can have both beliefs that I really want market forces to try to rally around sustainability. I really believe in sustainability, but at the same time, if right now isn't the right moment or the market doesn't want it right now, that is what it is.
It is what it is.
Yeah, that was refreshing.
And so, if I wanted to take my retirement account and be able to invest it in ESG driven companies, then I should have the right to do that, right? And there is that's the beauty of the market that you don't see in government, because the beauty of the market is real-time, real-world accountability. If you have a concept that works, you can benefit from it greatly. If you don't, you're going to get crushed. And you're exactly right. There are companies who captured the ESG ethos but didn't have the business model in place to make it happen. And what happened to them? We actually mentioned one of them just earlier, right? And so the point is, I guess this is going to be the theme of our conversation, folks, friends, but, you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But let's let the will of the market dictate what our options are rather than a political class who largely doesn't understand the dynamics of the business community.
Amen.
Evan's loving this. I know he is.
Evan's very smart. You're no joke, Logan.
We have some great conversations together. No doubt about that. And, you know, one of the things that as we're talking about why this is so important. I think to bring it back to conversations that Evan and I have had literally on the last episode of this podcast, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit as well, is the need for electrifying everything and providing this sustainable energy source at the scale we're trying to provide it at. Tie it back to where you see the AI space rapidly advancing towards and this need for all of this compute that is so energy intensive. We cannot be running these things on non-renewable energy sources. So when you just think, when you start extrapolating out, it's like, what is the future going to look like? And we've got all these electric cars and we've got all these, you know, server farms where we're running all of these artificial intelligence compute models. We need tons and tons of energy, way more energy than we're consuming now, but it cannot be from sources that we're producing it.
That's exactly right. And so what it looks like, it's going to be a mobilization. And there'll be some history nerds listening to this, and I'm certain I'll get the metaphor wrong, but let's follow the spirit here, is that when Hitler walked into Poland, I think America had the 13th or 15th largest army in the world, and we mobilized fully overnight, and everybody knows the outcome. We saved the world for democracy, went on to build the biggest middle class in the history of the planet, and provided for 75 years of unprecedented peace and prosperity on the planet. I think what we're going to see is a mobilization, and it will just hasten. The opening shot is the Inflation Reduction Act. We got deadly serious about moving this. You are the change in attitude that I am seeing from Kentucky-based utilities that were serious laggards on renewable energy when we spoke just a few years ago formally. The difference between where they were then and where they are now is they are responding to the market. And we now have government policies that have caught up with the will of the market, which means this has been supercharged. But to bring this home to a point you made, think of how awesome it is to be alive now, because even for, you know, you guys are early 30s, I'm guessing, right?
They're about
late 20s. You know, so my senior year at UK was the first year that we used email, okay? And so I got to be party to the digital revolution. We are living in the early stages of the green energy revolution. And then on top of this, you're going to overlay the AI revolution. I'm not sure that any time in human history, even back to the Renaissance, have you seen this confluence in change in culture and technology and finance that we're seeing right now. And I think the defining, I think the definition of our age is how we manage these three incredible. If you take any of them independently, you've got an epic defining event, right? And that we've got three of these things happening within 30 years of one another, and then happening in confluence. It's extraordinary. I mean, the experience. My boys are 18. You got 18-year-old twin boys. What this world will look like when they are 36 is just utterly mind-blowing. And I'm not talking the George Jetson stuff, flying cars, but maybe we are, right? Because who could have contemplated artificial intelligence as recently as 10 or 15 years ago, right? I mean, there were some smart people who were on the tip of the spear pioneering some mind-blowing stuff. But now it's entered the public domain in a way that is increasingly becoming mainstream. In one generation, we've seen the world connected via the web. We're fundamentally changing the way we power almost every aspect of our lives. And we're going to see technology utilized in a way that none of us could contemplate as recently as a handful of years ago. This is an extraordinary moment in history.
This is actually one of my favorite topics to talk about, because there's a book, it's Sapiens, which is a pretty popular book in tech circles, and a lot of people like to make fun of it as well. I realize that, but it's about the history of Homo sapiens and the evolution of our species, and it lays out the timeline of how things happened, the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, the information revolution, all of these kind of hugely important revolutions throughout the evolution of our species. And when you look at it on a timeline, you realize how condensed each one that comes after the next one, how quickly things are starting to accelerate. And to your point, we're now at this time where all of them are starting to converge at once. And I mean, you mentioned three of the biggest ones, but we also have things like space exploration that is now becoming much more possible. We have internet that is now connecting us via satellite. We have biotechnology that's accelerating at a rapid pace with things like CRISPR. I mean, literally, I don't think there is a more exciting time that you could be alive.
Right. And so in the future always belongs to the optimist, I think. But how could anybody listen to what you just laid out, which I agree with in its entirety, and bet against innovation? It's literally defining every aspect of our lives. There is going to be there's no reversion here, folks. This is a rocket ship. And the evolution of human civilization has gotten us to the point where the speed of change hastens and our institutions have to adopt, so whether it be government, whether it be, you know, the banking and finance culture that we've talked about. Like, this, it ain't slowing down to catch up with the rest of us. And I, for one, I appreciate why that is so disquieting to so many people. But I, for one, revel in the moment. And I think it represents a catapult opportunity for places like Kentucky that have been left behind, right? And the problem is, if you miss this once in a 400 or 500 year opportunity, if you miss it, it's a long time before the next one comes along. And that's why I have so much frustration with politics. It's why I have so much frustration with a culture that isn't as dynamic as the entrepreneurial spirit that with the people with whom we socialize.
Absolutely. And it just speaks to being a disruptor. And as you dubbed it, I haven't heard this term, but the modernizer. I love that term as well. You know, being able to recognize these sorts of trends and being able to step into them and kind of take the moment and realize that this is an opportunity, not just for you as the entrepreneur, but for the state as a whole. And, you know, this is one of the interviews I was really looking forward to this season because, like I said at the beginning, energy is the origin of everything. And to be working on a project that is that large is just, it's inspiring. And it's really fun to share.
And we all have a moment where we're just like, did that just happen? And so one of the things I don't think I've gotten to share with y'all, but it certainly happened last spring, certainly since we've been together a few years ago. I was invited to Saudi Arabia to keynote a green energy conference. So here's this Kentucky kid with this accent, and folks listening, it's not affected. This is really how I talk. I am keynoting a conference put on by the American Commercial Embassy and the American Chamber of Commerce in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, talking about social impact solar, talking about the opportunity to leverage the green energy economy to diversify wealth and to create new opportunities for people who've been left behind in Saudi Arabia. And then, you know, to come home and be told, well, the, you know, climate change is a hoax and that the, you know, green energy isn't real and that we're going to continue doing what we've done for a long time. Y'all, if the Saudis are doubling down on green energy, it's probably an indication that we ought to be doing the same.
Right. That's a great statement. And it's just so cool. I think one of the exciting things about having you on the podcast and just watching you speak is how optimistic you are. And those stories like that get us fired up about what's going on.
Yeah, man, we got to get fired up. And I am generally optimistic. I'm optimistic about people, and I'm optimistic about what ambitious people can do working together. What I am pessimistic about is our institutions. I mean, I think in so many ways, you know, our economic development strategy, it is, again, it's a huge deal that we're recruiting these big companies, but the big companies started off as Henry Ford was a dude in a warehouse in Detroit before Ford became what it is. And what are we doing to generate to that kind of seed capital and seed investment to create organic leadership in entrepreneurs? Because our aim for long-term prosperity shouldn't be to try to steal existing companies from other jurisdictions or to recruit them from other places, although that's important. The heart of it has got to be growing your own, man. And as excited as we are about farm to table, we need to have the same approach with entrepreneurs. I mean, I think our economic developers, our elected officials need to be doing everything to celebrate, you know, the next generation of the Logans and Evans and what you're doing and saying, what can we do to make this happen? What do we need to modernize in our own structure to make it easier for you to create opportunity here in Lexington or more broadly in Kentucky or in the South or wherever? That's where we've got to get. But you don't ask that question unless you're grounded in the experience, which is why everybody listening to this podcast, of which there are a whole bunch, you don't have to run for office, but you have an obligation to be involved in civil discourse. You have an obligation to be involved in our democratic processes, because if not, you're going to continue to get a system that fundamentally doesn't understand you. And this is just where we are, y'all. In the days of businesses banding together and being able to have their approach represented by the Chamber of Commerce. And don't get me wrong, chambers are very important. We've got a great chamber here in Lexington, but the needs of the dynamic business environment are so nuanced that we've got to find ways to build bridges between disruptors in the private sector and the people who make the laws that govern us.
Yeah. And I think if I were to add to that, I would say, you know, why now? Why is right now the time to really invest in entrepreneurship and builders? And I would say we're at a very unique time in history where a lot of the tools traditionally that it takes to build a company have been democratized. And especially with artificial intelligence becoming what it is and everybody having to address it, whether you're Humana, Ford, anybody, whether you're in Kentucky or any part of the world, you know, we have to address the fact that right now is one of the easier times to really just build what you have on your mind. And if we address that as a state and say to our youth, hey, you can be a builder, whether you're in Kentucky or not, you're here, build. And I think that right now is a unique time to do that because the tools that it takes to build, especially within the digital economy, are really becoming democratized and the access is wide open. And so, you know, we no longer have to necessarily rely on manufacturing or coal. And right here in Kentucky, we can build because the democratization of these tools is happening now. And so I'd say that's like the why now, is that there's just such a great opportunity in front of the youth today that have grown up with technology in their face, you know, iPads, iPhones, TikTok, you know, they can use that digital experience to build. And so I think that that is kind of the why now.
It is the why now. And to your point, why I'm so excited about technology writ large is that it liberates from the tyranny of geography. And that is to say, when I was a kid, a little kid, we had this thing called the bookmobile. And this is going to sound totally foreign to you. I promise this wasn't something out of the Flintstones, which was an old cartoon, by the way, guys. But you know, the local library had a van shelved internally with books, and they would go around to places, and kids or adults could pick books. And I thought on the credenza behind my desk is a black and white picture from the 50s, long before I came along, but of the bookmobile operating in Eastern Kentucky. And to your point, that was how we democratized information back then. You know, a kid from the Mississippi Delta or a Pueblo community in New Mexico or in Appalachia now has the ability through connectivity to access the galleries of the Louvre and the Musée d'Orsay and to see the masterpieces of that era. That is unbelievably cool. That happened 20 years ago. The era of which that's happening now, to your point, is the democratization of everything. And I think that is super cool. And so we got to make sure we've got a culture that says, go out and dare greatly. And if you fail, we're not going to dance on your grave. We're going to do what we need to do to make sure you learned your lessons, pick up and start again. We're going to build capital networks that understand that we're betting on you over the long term and not the short term. And we're going to give the freedom to the market to do what it does best. And that's innovate efficiently.
I love that. And one thing I want to add to what you're saying just about the democratization of information is something that I've noticed that a lot of young people inherently understand now the power of is not only do you have access to all of this information and you're connected to it, but you can also contribute to it yourself. So like Middle Tech is, I've seen this in my own life. I take these thoughts that I have that Evan and I talk about in private, and we can now put them out onto the internet where anybody can listen to them. And the amount of opportunity that can be generated from that or attracting other like-minded people, that is a very powerful thing that our generation seems to understand inherently is you can take what's in your mind, put it out on the internet, and then watch it blossom from there. And I think that's an important part of all of this as we're talking about connectivity and the democratization of opportunity and information, is letting those two things become married.
And I'd add one thing. I think that's brilliant. I would add one thing in that open sourcing access to information is critical, but the obligation it invites is that we still have to find a way to agree on facts.
100%.
And
yes.
So that is so important, guys, is that, and again, I want to call back to what I think is the natural advantage of the entrepreneur in decision-making, is that an entrepreneur who makes decisions based on ideology rather than information will not succeed. It is a fact. If you approach the world with a concrete worldview that says, I must think this way to solve this problem, then entrepreneurship is not the place for you. If you have intellectual curiosity and a confidence in what you believe and a commitment to outcome over process, then entrepreneurship is for you. But ultimately, I think what I've just described is why some of our governing institutions are failing right now. I mean, literally, if an entrepreneur defines success as the ability to avoid a budget shutdown, you wouldn't be in business for very long, right? That is can we all admit that's a really low bar, right? And so the heightened culture that you get as an entrepreneur, the openness, being an entrepreneur makes you the enemy of ideology. You can emerge from your entrepreneurial experiences with a worldview, but to be an effective entrepreneur, you have to be grounded in facts. And wishing it so doesn't make it so. And it doesn't mean you don't have core values. We've got plenty of core values. We're about upward mobility. We're totally founded in our mission. We're plain dealers. We will not trade on our integrity. But beyond that, whatever it takes for me to affect an outcome and return value to my shareholders, make sure that we can meet payroll, create a responsible profit, and leave the places we work better off, that's what our focus is. And that is the opposite of ideologically driven leadership.
I love that. That's so good. And it's so relevant right now too, with some of the discourse we've been seeing on social media. I want to move on to, speaking of social media segment here, we're calling it our 60-second segment. So this is more of a rapid fire sort of interview part of the conversation here. So we're just going to go through a couple of these questions and just answer them in 60 seconds, 90 seconds.
Which you know is not easy for me.
That's going to be tough for you. I know that's going to be tough for you. But we're going to try it anyway. We're going to try it so we can get these out on social media and see if we can get some engagement here. All right, first question here. What are the most important characteristics one should develop if they want to have a big positive impact?
Big vision, hard work, and building a team that can execute on that vision, and then creating a culture where everyone holds each other accountable.
I love that.
What is the most important failure you've had in your career, and what did you learn from it?
Dude, like I've got 1,000. We could talk about losing the governor's race. We could talk about the first couple of projects in the solar business that I tried to originate that died for various reasons. We could there are a lot of things. The central lesson I take from the failures that I have had are you got to have an appreciation for timing, and you've got to catch the spirit of the age and meet people where they are, right? So I don't know if that makes a lot of sense to you, but it means doing the homework, understand clearly what you're trying to accomplish, building the team to get it done, and then getting it done.
Now, one thing you said there, that there's been a lot of studies done on which startups or which ideas succeed, and timing is a massive component of that.
I have been the victim of good luck. I have been the beneficiary of good luck. I have been the victim of bad luck. Y'all, it just is what it is. It is a universal force. I don't know whether it's real or not, but I know that whatever it is, it plays a role in why some people are successful and why some are not. The only constant needs to be continued effort, because over the long term, your good luck and bad luck turn to even out.
That's it's like that famous quote. It's fair for everybody because it's fair for nobody.
It's exactly
like
right.
The only thing you can control is the effort you're putting into it. All right, last one here. What is your most contrarian take about building a business?
So this is the best piece. Not only is this the best piece of business advice I've ever gotten, it's probably one of the best pieces of life advice I've ever gotten. And I'm going to give credit to Jim Gray. So when my company was beginning to take off, and we were undercapitalized, and I had a decision to make about, do you hire talent or do you hire expertise? And I had dinner with Jim Gray, and Jim said, hire talent, lease expertise. And as a result of following that advice, I can now afford both. But that is so important. Passion, brains, commitment, talent, that's what you got to have. Expertise is learned, and you can rent that. But when you're disrupting, when you're pioneering, when you're innovating, it's far more important to have talent. And honestly, I was about to go the different direction. And that is one of those life-changing moments for me as an entrepreneur. And I don't, you know, listen, I think there's probably a reason why Jim Gray was such a successful mayor and a hell of a secretary of transportation, because this dude's able to call on that kind of wisdom. And he learned that because in his career, at one point, they hired expertise rather than talent. And I was able, the best piece of business advice I've ever gotten came from a terrific business guy, and it utterly changed the trajectory of my company.
That's a great one. And that's one I've seen play out at the companies that I've gotten to work at in my early career as well. All right. Final question here. We've talked a lot about, you know, Edlin Renewables and this future that you guys are building and renewable energy and sustainability. But let's end on this last question here. Talk about your vision for the future of Edlin Renewables, and just where you guys are building and the future you're trying to build.
So I want to continue to build legacy by maximizing our commitment through our mission statement to bring in the opportunity of renewable energy to the forgotten places of America. And I want us to double down on that mission. I'm super excited that we've been able to advance it in coal country. I'm excited about the work we're doing with Native American populations in New Mexico. The announcements that we'll have over the next couple of months are super exciting, but I want to continue to drive this as quickly and at scale as I possibly can while making sure we don't lose sight of our mission, right? You know, I'm as proud of the projects that we reject as the ones that we accept. And so I want to go faster. I want to go bigger, but that's all measured against making sure that we stay truthful and wholly committed to our mission. And so that's where we are. And I spent a lot of time as an aspiring young politician thinking 3, 4, 5 steps down the road. Now my job is to have that compelling vision, but to understand that there are steps that you take to get there. And it's about making sure you are sure-footed in the next step that you take.
Well, Adam, thanks so much for taking the time to come down here and talk to us. We're thrilled to hear about the progress you guys have made and the success you're seeing, and we're really grateful that you're doing it here in Lexington, Kentucky. So thanks for the time.
And thanks for providing the platform, guys. It's important.
Absolutely.